a landmark for the area near the railway station. Carved out of blocks of grey-black stone, with a square crown on its head, the cubist lion resembled a chess piece. The eye slits beneath the low brow stared across the plaza. The sculpture gave this part of town an avant-garde sensibility. Ghosh stepped into the chromed and lacquered world of Ferraro's, where a haircut cost 10 times as much as at Jai Hind, the Indian barbershop. But Ferraro's, with its frosted glass window and red and white striped barber's pole, was rejuvenating. The mirrored walls, the necklace of globe lights, the oxblood leather chair with more knobs and chrome levers than Missing's operating table, you could only get this at the Italian establishment. Ferraro, dazzling in his collarless white smock, was everywhere, behind Ghosh to slip off his coat, alongside him as he led him to the chair, then in front of him to slip on the gown. Ferraro chatted in Italian, and it didn't matter that Ghosh knew only a few words. The conversation was offered as background music, not requiring a response. He felt at ease with the older man. "Beware of a young doctor and an old barber," went the saying. But Ghosh thought both he and Ferraro were in good hands. Ferraro had soldiered in Eritrea before becoming a barber in Addis. Had they shared a common language, there was much that Ghosh would have asked. He'd have loved to hear about the 1940s typhus epidemic, during which some brilliant Italian official decided to douse the whole city with DDT, getting rid of lice and the typhus. How had the Italians handled VD and the troops who couldn't possibly have confined themselves to the 6 Italian ladies in Asmara who were the official garrison puttanas? He felt an urge to confide in Ferraro, to tell him how his chest ached with jealousy, how he was leaving the country because of a woman who didn't take his love seriously. Ferraro made a soft clucking noise, as if he had intuited the problem and its gender. Easing the chair into a reclining position was Ferraro's first step to finding a solution. Neither man could have guessed that at that moment, Sister Mary Joseph Praise's heart had stopped beating. Ferraro gently draped the first hot towel around Ghosh's neck. When the last towel was in place, blotting out all light, Ferraro felt tactfully quiet. Ghosh heard him tiptoe to where he'd parked his cigarette, and then the sound of his exhaling smoke. "If I could have a valet, this would be my man," Ghosh thought. One never doubted for a moment that it was Ferraro's destiny to be a barber. His instincts were perfect, his boldness was inconsequential. Ghosh emerged in a cloud of aftershave. Driving away, he took in the sights as if for the last time. Up the steep slope of Churchill Road and past Jai Hind to the traffic light where a balancing act between accelerator and clutch was required before the light turned green. He turned left and went past Vanilal's spice shop, Vartanian's fabrics and stopped at the post office. The leper child who staked out this territory where foreigners abounded had blossomed into a teen seemingly overnight. Her perky breasts pushed through her shama while the cartilage of her nose had collapsed to form a saddle nose. He put a 1 bur note into her clawed hand. He turned at the sound of castanets. A listiro, bottle caps threaded onto a nail on his shoebox, looked up at him. Ghosh stood against the post office wall along with a half dozen other men who were smoking or reading the paper while listiros worked like bees at their feet. "The Italians are responsible for this, too," Ghosh thought. "People getting their shoes shined more often than they bathe." It was starting to drizzle, and the listiro's elbows flew like pistons. On the nape of the boy's neck, Ghosh noticed a patch of albino white skin. Surely not the collar of Venus. So young and already with scars of healed syphilis. Venereum insontium, innocently acquired syphilis, was still in the textbooks, though Ghosh didn't believe in such a thing. Other than congenital syphilis, where the mother infected the unborn child, he believed that all syphilis was sexually acquired. He'd seen 5-year-olds at play mimicking the act of copulation with each other and doing a good job of it. A sudden cloudburst sent Ghosh scrambling to his car. The rain washed off a coat of ennui that had enveloped the piazza. The streetlights came on and reflected off the chrome of passing cars. The Ambassa buses turned a vivid red. On the rooftop of the three-story Olivetti building, which also housed Pan Am, the Venezia Ristorante, and Motilal Import Exports, the neon beer mug filled up with yellow lager, foamed over in white suds, then went dark before the cycle started again. That sign had been a source of such wonder when it was first put up. The barefoot men driving their sheep into town for Mescal Festival had stopped to watch the show, knotting up traffic as the herd got away from them. At St. George's Bar, rain dripped off the Campari umbrellas onto the patio. It was packed inside with foreigners and locals who felt the ambience worth the prices. The glass doors held in a rich scent of cannoli, biscotti, chocolate cassata, ground coffee, and perfume. A gramophone blended into the chatter of voices, the tinkle of cups and saucers, and the sharp sounds of chairs scraping back and glass smacking on formica-topped tables. He had just sat down at the bar when he saw Helen's reflection in the mirror. She was seated at a far corner table. She was short-sighted and probably wouldn't see him. Her fair features were striking against her jet-black hair. She was paying no attention to her companion, who was none other than Dr. Bocelli. Gauche's instinct was to leave at once, but the barman stood waiting, so he asked for a beer. "My God, Helen, you are so beautiful," Gauche muttered to himself, studying her reflection. St. George's didn't employ bar girls, but it had no objections to the classier women coming in. Helen's legs were crossed under her skirt, the skin of her thighs white as cream. He remembered those generous glutei that obviated any need for a supporting pillow. A mole on her jawline added to her distinction. But why was it the prettiest half-caste girls, the killies, as they were often called, though the term was derogatory, put on this air of being above it all and bored? Bocelli, his silk kerchief flowing out of his cream coat and matching his tie, appeared much older on this night than his 50 or so years. His carefully sculpted pencil mustache and his expression of equanimity, cigarette in hand, bothered Gauche because he saw in it his own inertia, the thing that had kept him in Africa so long. Gauche was fond of Bocelli. The man was not a great physician, but he knew his limits in medicine, though he didn't always know his limit in alcohol. Just a week ago, Gauche had been shocked to see Bocelli drunk and singing the Giovinezza, goose-stepping down the middle of the road in the heart of the piazza. It was near midnight, and Gauche had stopped his car then and tried to get him off the street. Bocelli became loud and boisterous, screaming about Adoa, which was enough to get him beaten up if he persisted. Bocelli was lost in the memory of boarding his troop ship in Naples in 1934. He was a young officer again in the 230th Legion of the National Fascist Militia, off to fight for Il Duce, off to capture Abyssinia, off to expunge the shame of being defeated at the Battle of Adowa by Emperor Menelik in 1896. At Adowa, 10,000 Italian soldiers, with as many of their Eritrean askaris, poured down from their colony to invade and take Ethiopia. They were defeated by Emperor Menelik's barefoot Ethiopian fighters armed with spears and Remingtons, sold to them by none other than Rambo. No European army had ever been so thoroughly thrashed in Africa. It stuck in the Italian craw, so that even men who weren't born at the time of Adowa, like Bocelli, grew up wanting vengeance. Gauche didn't understand any of this till he came to Africa. He hadn't realized that Menelik's victory had inspired Marcus Garvey's Back to Africa movement, and that it had awakened Pan-African consciousness in Kenya, the Sudan, and the Congo. For such insights, one had to live in Africa. The Italians never forgot their humiliation, and so on the next try, some 40 years later, Mussolini took no chances. His motto was qualsiasi mezzo, win by any means. The monkey-maned Ethiopian horsemen, with leather shields and spears and single-shot rifles, found the enemy was a cloud of phosgene gas that choked them to death. Geneva Protocol be damned. Bocelli had been part of that, and looking at Bocelli's face, so flushed with liquor and pride, as he did his victory march in the piazza, Ghosh had realized it must have been Bocelli's proudest moment. Ghosh sat, trying to be inconspicuous at the bar, but watching the couple in the mirror. When Ghosh first met Helen, he'd fallen madly in love with her, for a few days. Every time Helen saw him, she'd say, "Give me money, please." When he asked for what, she'd blink and then pout as if the question were unreasonable. She'd say, "My mother died," or, "I need abortion," whatever came into her head. Most bar girls had hearts of gold and eventually married well, but Helen's heart was of baser metal. Poor Bocelli was smitten by Helen and had been for years, even though he had a common-law Eritrean wife. He gave Helen money. He expected and accepted her selfishness. He called her his donna delinquente, offering the mole on her cheek as proof. Ghosh meant to ask Bocelli if he actually believed anything in Lombroso's abominable book, La Donna Delinquente. Lombroso's studies of prostitutes and criminal women uncovered characteristics of degeneration, such things as primitive pubic hair distribution, an atavistic facial appearance, and an excess of moles. It was pseudoscience. Utter rubbish. Ghosh slipped out abruptly without finishing his beer, because suddenly the idea of making small talk with either of them that evening was intolerable. The Avakians were locking up their bottled gas store, and beyond their shop, the lights of the piazza, the transitory illusion of Roma, came to an end. Now it was all darkness, and the road ran past the long, gloomy fortress-like stone wall that held up the hillside. A gash in the moss-covered stones was Saba Darija, 70 steps, a pedestrian shortcut to the roundabout of Sidist Kilo, though the steps were so worn down that it was more a ramp than stairs, treacherous when it rained. He drove past the Armenian church, then around the obelisk at Arat Kilo, another war monument at a roundabout, past the Gothic spires and domes of the Trinity Cathedral and then the Parliament building, which took its inspiration from the one on the banks of the Thames. At the old palace, because he was not quite ready to head home, he turned down to Casa Inces, a neighborhood of pretty villas. He wasn't in the mood for the Ibis or one of the big bars in the piazza that employed 30 hostesses. He saw a simpler cinder block building up ahead. It appeared to be partitioned into four bars. There were hundreds of such places all over Addis. A soft neon glow showed from two doorways. A plank forded the open gutter. He chose the door on the right, pushing through the bead curtain. It was, as he had suspected given the size, a one-woman operation. The tube light had been painted orange, creating a womb-like interior, exaggerated by the frankincense smoking on the charcoal brazier. Two padded bar stools fronted a short wooden counter. The bottles on the shelf on the back wall were impressive. Pinch, Johnny Walker, Bombay Gin, even if they were filled with home-brewed Tej. His Majesty Haile Selassie I, in bodyguard uniform, gazed down from a poster on one wall. A leggy woman in a swimsuit smiled back at His Majesty from a Michelin calendar. What little floor space remained held a table and two chairs. Here, the barmaid sat with a customer who held her hand. The man seemed intent on keeping her attention. Just when Ghosh decided there was no point in staying, she wrenched her hand free, scraped her chair back, stood, and bowed. High heels to show off her calves. Dark polish on her toenails, very pretty, he thought. The smile seemed genuine and suggested a better disposition than Helen's. The other man pushed sullenly past Ghosh and left without a word. The land of milk and honey, Ghosh thought. Milk and honey and love for money. Now she and Ghosh traded how-are-yous and I-am-wells, bowing. The deep excursions diminishing till the last few were mere inclinations of the head. Ghosh eased onto the bar stool as she circled behind the counter. She was perhaps 20, but with big bones, and the fullness of her blouse suggested she had mothered at least one child. "Minte titale?" she asked, thrusting her finger at her mouth in case he didn't understand Amharic. "I deeply regret that I drove your admirer away. Had I known he was here, or how much he cared for you, I could never have intruded on such a tryst." She gasped with surprise. "Him? He wanted to keep that one beer going till daylight without buying me one. He is from Tigray. Your Amharic is better than his," she said, gushing, relieved that it would not be a night of sign language. Her gauzy white cotton skirt ended just below her knees. The colorful border was repeated on the piping of the blouse, and again in the frill of the shama over her shoulders. Her hair was straightened and permed, a western do. A collar of tattoos in the form of closely spaced wavy lines made her neck look longer. Pretty eyes, Ghosh thought. Her name was Turunesh, but he decided to call her what he was in the habit of calling all women in Addis, Conjit, which meant beautiful. "I'll have blessed St. George's, and please, serve one for yourself. We must celebrate." She bowed her thanks.
"Is it your birthday, then?"
"No, Conjit, even better." He was about to say, "It is the day that I have freed myself from the chains of a woman who has deviled me for over a decade. The day I have decided my sojourn in Africa ends and America awaits. It is the day I have set eyes on the most beautiful woman in Addis Ababa." Her teeth were strong and even. A rim of upper gum showed when she laughed. She was self-conscious about this because she brought her hand to her mouth. Something inside him melted at the sound of her happy laughter, and for the first time since waking that morning, he felt almost normal. When he first arrived in Addis Ababa, he'd sunk into a deep depression. He'd considered leaving at once because he'd found that he'd completely misunderstood Hema's intention in sending for him. What he thought was the triumphant conclusion of a courtship that began when they were interns in India turned out to be in his head alone. Hema thought she was just doing Ghosh and missing a favor. Ghosh hid his embarrassment and humiliation. It was the time of the long rains, and that alone was enough to make a man kill himself. The ibis in the piazza saved him. He'd been looking for a drink and was attracted by an entrance with an arch of ivy that was festooned with Christmas lights. He could hear music from within and the sounds of womanly laughter. Inside, he thought he died and returned as Nebuchadnezzar. In those ibis women, Lulu, Marta, Sarah, Sahai, Meskel, Sheba, Mebrat, and in the sprawling bar and restaurant that occupied two floors and three enclosed verandas, he found a family. The girls welcomed him like a long-lost friend, restoring his good humor, encouraging the joker in him, always happy to sit with him. Feminine good looks were as abundant as the rain outside. Skin tones ranged from café au lait to coal. The few half-caste women at Ibis had white or olive-toned skin and blue-brown or even green eyes. The coming together of races generally produced the most exotic and beautiful fruit. However, the core was unpredictable and often sour. But of all the qualities of the women he met in Addis, the most important was their acquiescence, their availability. For months after his arrival in Addis, well after his discovery of the Ibis and so many other bars like it, Ghosh was celibate. The irony of that period was that the one woman he wanted rejected his advances, while all around him were women who never said no. He was 24 and not totally inexperienced when he arrived in Ethiopia. The only intimacy he'd ever had in India was with a young probationer by the name of Virgin Magdalene Kumar. Shortly after their 3-month affair ended, she left the order and married a chap he knew, and presumably changed the name to Magdalene Kumar.
Hema, I am only human, he murmured now, as he did every time he thought he was being unfaithful to her.
He reached across and felt the flesh under Conjit's ribs, pinching up a skin fold.
Ah, my dear, should we send for dinner? We need to put flesh on you, and sustenance for what we are about to do tonight. It is, I will confess to you, my very, very first time.
Had she been an older woman, and many one-woman bars were run by older women who had saved money for their own place after working somewhere grand like the Ibis, he would have used a different tone, one that was less direct, more courtly, a gentler form of flattery. But with her, he had settled on the naughty schoolboy approach. When she reached to feel his hair, rub his scalp, go spurred with contentment. On the radio, the muffled twang of a crowd repeated a 6-note riff from a pentatonic scale that seemed common to all Ethiopian music, fast or slow.
Ghosh recognized the song, a very popular one. It was called Tizita. There was no single equivalent English word. Tizita meant memory tinged with regret. Was there any other kind? Ghosh wondered.
Your skin is beautiful. What are you, Banya? She asked.
Yes, my lovely, I am indeed Indian. And since nothing about me other than my skin is beautiful, you are gracious to say so.
No, no, why do you say that? I swear on the saints I wish I had your hair. I can't get over your Amharic. Are you sure your mother is not Habesha?
You flatter me, he said.
He learned a little Amharic in the hospital, but it was only through tete-a-tetes like this that he became fluent. He had a theory that bedroom Amharic and bedside Amharic were really the same thing. Please lie down. Take off your shirt, open your mouth, take a deep breath. The language of love was the same as the language of medicine.
Really, I only know the Amharic of love. If you sent me outside to buy a pencil, I wouldn't be able to do it, for I lack those words.
She laughed and again tried to cover her lips. Ghosh held her hands, and so she drew her lower lip up, as if to hide her teeth. A gesture he found nubile and touching.
But why hide your smile?
There, how beautiful.
Much, much later, they retired to the back room. He closed his eyes and pretended, as he always did, that she was Hema, a most willing Hema.
The mist was inches off the ground when he emerged, and it had brought with it a funereal silence and bone-chilling cold. He took a leak by the roadside. A hyena laughed, whether at his action or his equipment, he couldn't be sure. He spun around and saw lupine retinas shining from the trees beyond the first set of houses. He ran while trying to zip up, unlocked his car, and jumped in. He quickly started the engine and moved off. A peeing man had to worry about more than hyenas. Shifters, labors, Majid Ratmachi, and all sorts of villains were a threat after midnight, even in the heart of the city and near paved roads. Just the previous month, 2 men had robbed, raped, and then cut off an English woman's tongue, thinking its absence would prevent her from tattling. Another victim of a robbery had his balls cut off, a common enough practice, in the belief that he would have no courage left to extract revenge. They were the lucky ones. The rest were simply murdered. The gates of Missing were wide open when he got back, which was strange. He pulled up to his cottage, slid the car into the open-sided shed. As his light shone on the rock wall, he slammed the brakes, terrified by what he saw. A ghostly white figure rose from a squat to stand before his headlights, the eyes reflecting back a shimmering red, just like the hyena's eyes. But this was no hyena, but a weeping, bereft Almaz who had clearly been waiting for him.
Hema, Hema, what have you done?
he muttered to himself, convinced that the worst had happened and Hema had returned married. Why else would Almaaz stay so late except to tell him this? She and the whole world knew how he felt about Hema. The only person who didn't know was Hema. The ghostly figure ran over to the passenger side, opened the door, and climbed in. Bowing her head, and in the most formal tone and without meeting his eyes, she said,
"I am sorry to bring you bad news."
"It's Hema, isn't it?"
"Hema? No. It is Sister Mary Joseph Prays."
"Sister? What happened to Sister?"
"She is with the Lord. May he bless her soul."
"What?"
"Lord, help us all, but she is dead."
Almaaz was sobbing now.
"She died giving birth to twins. Dr. Hema arrived but could not save her. Dr. Hema saved the twins."
Ghosh stopped hearing after her first mention of Sister and death. He had to have her repeat what she said, and then repeat again everything that she knew, but each time it came down to Sister being dead, and something about twins.
"And now we can't find Dr. Stone,"
she said at last.
"He is gone. We must find him. Matron says we must."
"Why?" Ghosh managed to ask when he found his tongue, but even as he said that, he knew why. He shared with Stone the bond of being the only male physicians at Missing. Ghosh knew Stone as well as anyone could know Stone, except perhaps Sister Mary Joseph Braves.
"Why? Because he is suffering the most," Almaaz said. "That is what Matron says. We must find him before he does something stupid."
"It's a bit too late for that," Ghosh thought. Chapter 12 Land's End. The morning after the births and the death, Matron Hurst came to her office very early, as if it were any other day. She'd slept but a few hours. She and Ghosh had driven around, hunting for Thomas Stone late into the night. Stone's maid, Rosina, had kept a vigil in his quarters, but there had been no sign of him. Matron pushed away the papers stacked on her desk. Through her window, she could see patients lined up in the outpatient department, or rather, she could see their colorful umbrellas. People believed the sun exacerbated all illnesses, so there were as many umbrellas as there were patients. She picked up the phone.
"Adam,"
she said when the compounder came on the line,
"please send word to Gebru to close the gate. Send patients to the Russian hospital."
Her Amharic, though accented, was exceedingly good.
"And Adam, please deal with the patients who are already in the outpatient department as best you can. I'll be asking the nurses to make rounds on their wards and to manage. Let the probationers know that all nursing classes are cancelled."
Thank God for Adam, Matron thought. His education had stopped at the third grade, which was a shame because Adam could have easily been a doctor. Not only was he adept at preparing the 15 stock mixtures, ointments, and compounds which Missing provided to outpatients, he also had uncanny clinical sense. With his one good eye, the other milky white from a childhood infection, he could spot the seriously ill among the many who came clutching the teal-blue graduated Missing medicine bottles, ready to have them refilled. It was a sad fact that the commonest complaint in the outpatient department was,
"Rashen, Liebhen, Hodhen."
Literally,
"My head, my heart, my stomach,"
with the patient's hand touching each part as she pronounced the words. Ghosh called it the RLH syndrome. The RLH sufferers were often young women or the elderly. If pressed to be more specific, the patients might offer that their heads were spinning, Rashen Yazoregnal, or burning, Yakatelegnal, or their hearts were tired, Libdekum, or they had abdominal discomfort or cramps, Hotkutet. But these symptoms were reported as an aside and grudgingly, because Rashen, Libhen, Hodhen should have been enough for any doctor worth his salt. It had taken Matron her first year in Addis to understand that this was how stress, anxiety, marital strife, and depression were expressed in Ethiopia.
Somatization was what Ghosh said the experts called this phenomenon. Psychic distress was projected onto a body part, because culturally it was the way to express that kind of suffering. Patients might see no connection between the abusive husband or meddlesome mother-in-law or the recent death of their infant and their dizziness or palpitations. And they all knew just the cure for what ailed them, an injection. They might settle for Mistura Carminativa or else a magnesium trisolate and belladonna mixture or some other mixture that came to the doctor's mind, but nothing cured like the mafe, the needle. Ghosh was dead against injections of vitamin B for the RLH syndrome, but Matron had convinced him it was better for missing to do it than have the dissatisfied patient get an unsterilized hypodermic from a quack in the Mercato. The orange B-complex injection was cheap, and its effect was instantaneous, with patients grinning and skipping down the hill. The phone rang, and for once Matron was grateful. Normally she hated the sound, because it always felt like a rude interruption. The small missing switchboard was still a novelty. Matron had declined an extension in her quarters, but she thought it was important to have phones in the doctor's quarters and the casualty room. Even this phone in her office she considered a luxury, but now she grabbed the receiver, hoping for good news. News about Stone.
"Please hold for His Excellency, the Minister of the Pen," a female voice said.
Matron heard faint clicks and imagined a little dog walking on the wooden floors of the palace. She stared at the stacks of Bibles against the far wall. There were so many they looked like a barricade of shiny, cobbled rexin. The minister came on, asked about Matron's health, and then said,
"His Majesty is saddened by your loss. Please accept his deepest condolences."
Matron pictured the minister standing, bowing as he spoke into the phone.
"His Majesty personally asked me to call."
"It is most kind of His Majesty to think of us at this time," Matron said.
It was part of the Emperor's mystique and a key to his power that he knew everything that went on in his empire. She wondered how word had reached the palace so soon. Dr. Thomas Stone, with Sister Mary Joseph Praise assisting, had removed a pair of royal appendices, and Hamer had performed an emergency cesarean section on a granddaughter who didn't make it to Switzerland. Since then, a few others in the royal family came to Hamer for their confinement. Matron only had to ask, the minister said, if there was something the palace could do. The minister didn't touch on the manner of sister's death or the fate of the two babies.
"By the way, Matron," he said,
and she was alert because she sensed this was the real reason for the call.
"If by any chance a senior officer comes to missing for treatment, for surgery in the next day or so, the Emperor would like to be informed. You can call me personally."
He gave her a number.
"What sort of officer?"
She took the silence to mean the minister was giving thought to his answer.
"An imperial bodyguard officer. An officer who has, shall we say, no need to be at missing."
"Surgery, you say? Oh no, we've closed the hospital. We have no surgeon, minister. You see, Dr. Thomas Stone is indisposed. They were a team, you see."
"Thank you, Matron. Please let us know."
She mulled over the call after she hung up. Emperor Haile Selassie had built up a strong modern military, consisting of army, navy, air force, and the imperial bodyguard. The bodyguard was a force as large as the others, the equivalent of the Queen's Guard in England who stood outside Buckingham Palace. But just like the Queen's Guard, the imperial bodyguard wasn't merely a ceremonial unit. Its professional soldiers and its units were no different than the rest of the armed forces and trained for battle. Up-and-coming cadets from all the services went to Sandhurst, or West Point, or Pune. But these sojourns had a way of expanding one's social conscience. The Emperor feared a coup by these young officers. Having the second or third largest standing armed force on the continent was a matter of pride.
but it was also potentially dangerous to his reign. The emperor deliberately kept the four services in competition with one another, kept their headquarters far apart, and he transferred generals who were getting too powerful. Matron sensed some such intrigue. Why else would the minister of the pen call personally? The minister had no idea what it meant for missing not to have a surgeon, Matron thought. Before Thomas Stone's arrival, Missing could handle most internal medicine and pediatric patients, thanks to Ghosh, and it tackled complicated obstetric and gynecologic conditions, thanks to Hema. Over the years, a number of other doctors had come and gone, some of them capable of surgery. But Missing never had a fully trained and competent surgeon till Stone. A surgeon allowed Missing to fix complex fractures, remove goiters and other tumors, perform skin grafts for burns, repair strangulated hernias, take out enlarged prostates or cancerous breasts, or drill a hole in the skull to let out a blood clot pressing against the brain. Stone's presence, with an assistant like Sister Mary Joseph Braise, took Missing to a new level. His absence changed everything. The phone rang again a few minutes later, and this time the sound was ominous. Matron brought the instrument gingerly to her ear. Please, God, let Stone be alive.
Hello? This is Eli Harris, of the Baptist Congregation of Houston. Hello?
For a call from America, the connection was crystal clear. Matron was so surprised that she said nothing.
Hello?
The voice said again.
Yes?
Matron said gruffly.
I'm speaking from the Gion Hotel in Addis Ababa. Could I speak to Matron Hurst?
She held the receiver away, covering the mouthpiece. She felt panicked and confused. What on earth was Harris doing here? She was accustomed to dealing with donors and charitable organizations by mail. She needed to think quickly, but her mind refused to cooperate. At last, she took her hand away and brought the phone up.
I'll pass the message on, Mr. Harris. She will call you back.
May I know who is speaking?
You see, we have had a death of one of our staff. It might be a couple of days before she calls you.
He started to say something, but Matron hung up abruptly. Then she took the receiver off the hook, glaring at it, daring it to ring. The Baptists of Houston were of late Missing's best and most consistent funders. Matron sent out handwritten letters every week to congregations in America and Europe. She asked that her letter be forwarded to others if they were unable to help. If a reply came expressing any interest, she immediately mailed them Thomas Stone's textbook, The Expedient Operator, A Short Practice of Tropical Medicine. Though expensive to mail, it was better than any prospectus. Donors, she found, always had a prurient interest in what could go wrong with the human body, and the photographs and illustrations by Sister Mary Joseph Braise in the book satisfied that desire. A picture of a strange creature with the face of a pig, the furriness of a dog, and with small myopic eyes accompanied the chapter on appendicitis, and Matron always put her letter there as a bookmark. The legend read, "The wombat is a burrowing nocturnal marsupial found only in Australia, and the only reason to mention it is the dubious distinction it has in joining man and apes in ownership of an appendix." The book, more than any exchange of letters, had won the Houston Baptist's support. Ghosh arrived half an hour later, shaking his head.
"I went to the British Embassy. I drove around the city. I went to his house again. Rosina's there, and she hasn't seen him. I walked all over Missing's grounds."
"Let's take a ride," Matron said.
As they drove down to Missing's gate, they saw a taxi coming up the hill carrying a white man.
"That must be Eli Harris,"
Matron said, sliding down in the passenger seat with an alacrity that surprised Ghosh. She told him about Harris's call.
"If I remember correctly, I got Harris to fund a project that was your idea, a citywide campaign against gonorrhea and syphilis. Harris had come to see how we are doing."
Ghosh almost steered them off the road,
But we have no such project, Matron.
Of course not,
Matron sighed. Ghosh never looked his best in the morning, even after a bath and shave. He hadn't had time for either of these. Dark stubble swept up from his throat, detoured around his lips, and reached almost to his bloodshot eyes.
Where are we going? He said.
To Gulali. We need to make funeral arrangements.
They rode in silence.
The Gulali cemetery was on the outskirts of town. The road cut through a forest where the dense overhanging canopy of trees made it feel like dusk. Suddenly, the forbidding wrought iron gates loomed before them, standing out against the limestone walls. Inside, a gravel road led up to a plateau thick with eucalyptus and pine. There were no taller trees in Addis than in Gulali. They trudged between the graves, their feet crunching and crackling on the carpet of leaves and twigs. No urban sounds or voices were to be heard here, only the stillness of a forest and the quiet of death. A fine drizzle wet the leaves and branches, then gathered into big drops that plopped on their heads and arms. Matron felt like a trespasser. She stopped at a grave no larger than an altar Bible.
An infant, Ghosh,
she said, wanting to hear a living voice, even if it was only hers.
Armenian, judging by the name. Lord, she died just last year.
The flowers by the headstone were fresh. Matron began a Hail Mary under her breath. Further down were the graves of young Italian soldiers. Nato a Roma, or Nato a Napoli. But no matter where they were born, they were deceduto ad Addis Ababa. Matron's vision turned misty as she thought of them having died so very far from home. John Melly's face appeared to her, and she could hear Bunyan's hymn. It was the hymn they had played at his funeral. At times, the tune found her. The words came to her lips unbidden. She turned to Ghosh.
You know I was in love once?
Ghosh, who already looked troubled, froze where he stood.
You mean with a man?
He said at last, when he could speak.
Of course with a man,
she sniffed. Ghosh was silent for a long time. Then he said,
We imagine we know everything there is to know about our colleagues, but really how little we know.
I don't think I knew I loved Melly until he was dying. I was so young. Easiest thing in the world is to love a dying man.
Did he love you?
He must have. You see, he died trying to save me.
Her eyes welled up.
It was in 1935. I'd just arrived in the country, and I couldn't have picked a worse time. The emperor fled the city as the Italians were about to march in. The looters went to town, pillaging, raping. John Melly commandeered a truck from the British legation to come and get me. You see, I was volunteering at what is now missing. He stopped to help a wounded person on the street, and a looter shot him, for absolutely no reason.
She shuddered.
I nursed him for 10 days, and then he died. One day I'll tell you all about it.
Then, uncontrollably, she had to sit down, her head in her hands, weeping.
I'm all right, Ghosh. Just give me a minute.
She was mourning not Melly as much as the passage of the years. She'd come to Addis Ababa from England after getting restless teaching in a convent school and running the student infirmary. She'd accepted a post with Sudan Interior Mission to work in Harar, Ethiopia. In Addis, she'd found her orders were cancelled because the Italians had attacked, and so she had simply attached herself to a small hospital all but abandoned by the American Protestants. During that first year, she'd watched as soldiers, Some of the young men buried hair, as well as Italian civilians, poured in to populate the new colony. Carpenters, masons, technicians. The peasant Florino became Don Florino when he crossed the Suez. The ambulance driver reinvented himself as a physician. She had carried on, just as the Indian shopkeepers, the Armenian merchants, the Greek hoteliers, the Levantine traders had carried on during the occupation. Matron was still there in 1941 when the Axis's fortunes turned in North Africa and in Europe. From the Hotel Bella Napoli's balcony, Matron watched Wingate and his British troops parade into town, escorting Emperor Haile Selassie, who was returning after 6 years of exile. Matron had never set eyes on the diminutive emperor. The little man seemed astonished by the transformation of his capital, his head swiveling this way and that to take in the cinemas, hotels, shops, neon lights, multi-story apartment buildings, paved avenues lined with trees. Matron said to the Reuters correspondent standing beside her that perhaps the emperor wished he'd stayed in exile a little longer. To her chagrin, she was quoted verbatim, but fortunately as an anonymous observer in every foreign paper. She smiled at that memory. She rose, brushed away her tears. The two of them trudged on. They walked down the path between one row of graves, then back up another.
"No," Matron said abruptly. "This will never do. I can't imagine leaving our cherished daughter in this place."
Only when they broke out into the sunlight did Matron feel she could breathe.
"Ghosh, if you bury me in Guleli, I'll never forgive you," she said.
Ghosh decided silence was the best strategy.
"We Christians believe that in the Lord's second coming, the dead will be raised from the grave."
Ghosh was raised a Christian, a fact that Matron never seemed to remember.
"Matron, do you sometimes doubt?"
She noticed that his voice was hoarse. His eyelids sagged. She was reminded again that this was not her grief alone.
"Doubt is a first cousin to faith, Ghosh. To have faith, you have to suspend your disbelief. Our beloved sister believed. I worry that in a place as damp and disconsolate as Guleli, even sister will find it hard to rise when the time comes."
"What then? Cremation?"
One of the Indian barbers doubled as a pujari and arranged cremations for Hindus who died in Addis Ababa.
"Of course not."
She wondered if Ghosh was being willfully dense.
"Burial. I think I might know just the place,"
Matron said.
They parked at Ghosh's bungalow and walked to the rear of Missing, where the bottle brush was so laden with flowers that it looked as if it had caught fire. The property edge was marked by the acacias, their flat tops forming a jagged line against the sky. Missing's far west corner was a promontory looking over a vast valley. That acreage, as far as the eye could see, belonged to a Raz, a duke, who was a relative of His Majesty Haile Selassie. A brook, hidden by boulders, burbled. Sheep grazed under the eye of a boy who sat polishing his teeth with a twig, his staff nearby. He squinted at Matron and Ghosh and then waved. Just as in the days of David, he carried a slingshot. It was a goatherd like him, centuries before, who had noticed how frisky his animals became after chewing a particular red berry. From that serendipitous discovery, the coffee habit and trade spread to Yemen, Amsterdam, the Caribbean, South America, and the world. But it had all begun in Ethiopia, in a field like this. An unused bore well occupied this corner of Missing. 5 years before, one of the missing dogs had fallen into the well. Kuchulu's desperate yelps brought Gibru. He fished her out by dangling a noose around her, almost lynching her in the process. The well needed to be sealed over. In supervising that task, Matron found used prophylactics and cigarette butts around the rock wall. She decided the area was in need of redemption. Coolies cleared the brush and planted native grass seedlings. In 2 months, a beautiful green carpet surrounded the well. Gebru tended to this lawn, squatting, crab-walking, grabbing a fistful of grass with his left hand and sweeping under it with a sickle in his right hand. It was Sister Mary Joseph Praise who identified the wild coffee bush by the well. But for Gebru's regularly nipping the top buds, it would have grown out of reach. With a few old outpatient benches brought to this lawn, it became a place where even Thomas Stone temporarily abandoned his cares. Cigarette in hand, mind adrift, he'd smoke and watch while Sister Mary Joseph Praise and Matron fussed with their plants. But before too long, he would grind his cigarette into the grass, a practice which Matron thought vulgar, and march off as if to some urgent summons.
Matron prayed silently. Dear God, only you know what will become of missing now. Two of ours are gone. A child is a miracle, and we have two of those. But for Mr. Harris and his people, it won't be that. For them, it would be shameful, scandalous, a reason to pull out. Missing had no income to speak of from patients. It relied on donations. Its modest expansion of the last few years came because of Harris and a few other donors. Matron had no rainy day fund. It was against her conscience to hold back money when money allowed her to cure trachoma and to prevent blindness, or give penicillin and cure syphilis. The list was endless. What was she to do? Matron studied the view in every direction. She wasn't registering what she saw because her thoughts were turned inward. But gradually, the valley, the scent of laurel, the vivid green colors, the gentle breeze, the way light fell on the far slope, the gash left by the stream, and above all this, the sweep of sky with clouds pushed to one side, it had its effect on her. For the first time since Sister Mary Joseph Braze's death, Matron felt a sense of peace, a sense of certainty where there had been none. She was certain that this was the spot. This was where the long voyage of Sister Mary Joseph Braze would end. She remembered, too, how in her first days in Addis, when things had looked so bleak, so terrifying, so tragic with Melly's death, it was at those moments that God's grace came, and that God's plan was revealed, though it was revealed in his time.
"I can't see it, Lord, but I know you can," she said.
Chapter 13. Praise in the Arms of Jesus. The barefoot coolies were jovial men. Told by Ghosh what their task would be, they made clucking sounds of condolence. The big fellow with the prognathic jaw shed his fraying coat. His shorter companion pulled off his tattered sweater. They spat on their palms, hefted the pickaxes, and set to it. Happened had happened, and be will be as far as they were concerned, and though it was a grave they were digging, it guaranteed the knight's bottle of tej or tala, and perhaps a bed and a willing woman. Sweat oiled their shoulders and foreheads and dampened their patchwork shirts. The sky had started off bluffing, convoys of grey clouds scurrying across like sheep to market. But by afternoon, a perfect blue canopy stretched from horizon to horizon. Ghosh, summoned to the casualty room by Matron, spotted a lean and very pale white man waiting by a pillar. Ghosh kept his head down, certain this was Eli Harris, and thankful that the man's back was to him. Inside, Adam pointed to a curtain. Ghosh heard regular grunting, coming with each breath and in the rhythm of a locomotive. He found 4 Ethiopian men standing there, 3 in sports coats and 1 in a burly jacket. They were gathered around the stretcher, as if in prayer. All 4 had spit-shined brown shoes. As they squeezed out to make room for Ghosh, he glimpsed a burgundy holster under a coat. "Doctor," the man lying on the table said, offering his hand and trying to rise, but wincing with the effort.
Mebratu is my name. Thank you for seeing me.
He was in his 30s, his English excellent. A thin mustache arched over a strong mouth. Pain had given him a peaked expression, but it was, nevertheless, an extraordinary handsome face, the broken nose adding to its character. He looked familiar, but Ghosh couldn't place him. Unlike his companions, he seemed stoic, not fearful, even though he was the one in pain.
I tell you, I have never hurt like this.
He grinned from ear to ear, as if to say, a man is going along when out of the blue comes a banana peel, a cosmic joke that leaves you upended and clutching your belly. A wave of pain made him wince. I can't possibly see you today. Beloved sister has died, and any minute I expect someone to tell me they have found Dr. Thomas Stone's body. For God's sake, go to the military hospital. That was what Ghosh wanted to say, but in the face of such suffering, he waited. Ghosh took the proffered hand, and while supporting it, he felt for the radial artery. The pulse was bounding at 112 per minute. Ghosh's equivalent of perfect pitch was to be able to tell the heart rate without a watch.
When did this start?
He heard himself say, taking in the swollen abdomen that was so incongruent on this lean, muscled man.
Begin at the beginning. Yesterday morning, I was trying to move my bowels.
The patient looked embarrassed.
And suddenly I had pain here.
He pointed to his lower abdomen.
While you were still sitting on the toilet? Squatting, yes. Within seconds I could feel swelling and tightening. It came on like a bolt of lightning.
The assonance caught Ghosh's ear. In his mind's eye he could see Sir Zachary Cope's little book, The Diagnosis of the Acute Abdomen in Rhyme. He'd found that treasure on the dusty shelf of a second-hand bookstore in Madras. The book was a revelation. Who knew that a medical text could be full of cartoon illustrations, be so playful, and yet provide serious instruction? Cope's lines regarding sudden blockage of the normal passage through the intestine came to him.
Rapid onset of distension will certainly attract your keen attention.
He asked the next question, even though he knew the answer. There were times like this when the diagnosis was written on the patient's forehead, or else they gave it away in the first sentence, or it was announced by an odor before one even saw the patient.
Yesterday morning, Mebratu replied. Just before the pain began. Since then, no stool, no gas, no nothing.
Sometimes a bowel coil gets out of place by twisting round upon a narrow base.
And how many enemas did you try?
Mebratu let out a short, sharp laugh.
You knew, huh? Two. But they did nothing.
He wasn't just constipated, but obstipated. Not even gas could pass. The bowel was completely obstructed. Outside the cubicle, the men seemed to be arguing. Mebratu's tongue was dry, brown, and furred. He was dehydrated, but not anemic. Ghosh exposed the grotesquely distended abdomen. The belly didn't push out when Mebratu took a breath. In fact, it moved hardly at all. This is my work, Ghosh thought to himself as he pulled out his stethoscope. This is my grave-digging equivalent, day in and day out, bellies, chests, flesh. In place of the normal gurgling bowel sounds, what he heard with his stethoscope was a cascade of high-pitched notes, like water dripping onto a zinc plate. In the background, he heard the steady drum of the heartbeat. Astonishing how well fluid-filled loops of bowel transmitted heart sounds. It was an observation he'd never seen in a textbook.
You have a volvulus, Ghosh said, pulling his stethoscope off his ears.
His voice came from a distance, and it didn't sound like it belonged to him.
A loop of the large bowel, the colon, twists on itself like this.
He used the tubing of his stethoscope to demonstrate first the formation of a loop, then the twist forming at the base. It's common here. Ethiopians have long and mobile colons. That and something about the diet predisposes to volvulus, we think. Mebrathu tried to reconcile his